Blog Talk Radio.
With a criminal matter, has the right to have their case heard before a judge or judicial officer of the court, is entitled to a fair and public hearing by a competent, independent and impartial court, have strict court rules enforced such as the right of reply, rules of evidence, and be found innocent or guilty, beyond reasonable doubt. Yet, our most vulnerable can have their rights, assets, and decision-making rights removed by a public servant of the state, not a judge, in a tribunal setting that can ignore evidence and facts, and determine matters as they see fit, and conclude matters based on probabilities alone. Are you scared yet?
Good evening, everyone. This is Marty Oakley of the PPJ Gazette Online, and this is the TS Radio Network. Our show tonight is Whistleblowers. It's brought to you in coordination with Marcel Reed and the Whistleblower Summit, taking place this year, July 28th through 31st in Washington, D.C. Hopefully that'll come off this year if we don't all expire. But anyway, we're hoping to be there. I hope you can be there, too. We had such a good turnout last year. I was really proud of everybody that took the time to show up. We had a huge, huge crowd. Thank you so much. Our guest tonight has authored a book, and that book is called The Zyprexa Papers. And the person who authored it is attorney Jim Gottstein. He's from Alaska. And this book is the result of some papers he came in contact with or somehow got into his possession that eventually caused a lawsuit. But in this story, he talks about particularly a man named Bill Bigley, who was subject to these drugs. And I think this is such an important story. And as you know, in dealing with all of this guardianship, which guardianship is mentioned in this book many times, how these guardians act, how they tried to prevent Mr. Gottstein from representing Mr. Bigley, how, you know, they interfered at every level, things were going on that he didn't know about. We see this routinely. What we're going to be talking about is the medication Zyprexa, and then another in a secondhand way called Haldol, and we're all familiar with both of these drugs. We have proven beyond a doubt that they are both used in what's called the kill shot in hospice. They are cut with 50% Roxanol, pure morphine. They give this shot. It's half Haldol or half Zyprexa, and within a very short amount of time, the person simply ceases to breathe. It's all over. These drugs are deadly. They have been known to be deadly, and he does an excellent job. Now, again, I want to tell you the name of the book is The Zyprexa Papers. It is available on Amazon. I have a direct link to it on the show promo. You can click right over there. It's a fast read, and it's a fast read because it's well written, and it's not interlaced with a ton of legalese that makes it almost impenetrable. This is written in an easy-to-understand format, and this thing will get you from the first page to the last. With that, help me welcome our guest, Mr. Gottstein. How you doing?
Thank you, Marty. Very well. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. I'm glad to have you. These drugs, Mr. Gottstein, we have been tracking them for many years and their use. So I was surprised when I saw this book. Many people, after I put the show promo up, were asking what these papers were that you got a hold of. Would you mind talking about that a little bit?
Sure. There was a massive lawsuit over Zyprexa causing people to get diabetes and other metabolic problems, including gaining massive amounts of weight in a short period of time. And some people would gain 100 pounds in a year.
Oh, wow.
And there were literally 25, two sets of 25,000 plaintiffs who had sued over this. And in lawsuits, they have what's called discovery, where you get to force the other side to produce, to give you documents. And Eli Lilly, the manufacturer, got negotiated a secrecy agreement with the plaintiffs, the lawyers, the people bringing the lawsuit, to keep everything secret. But there was a provision in it that said if one of the, you know, the experts, anybody in this case, an expert who had access to these documents was subpoenaed in another case, they had to give Lilly reasonable notice and an opportunity to object before producing, i.e. giving, in other words, giving the documents. So this expert, David Eagleman, Dr. David Eagleman, called me at the end of November in 2006, basically to say, I want you to subpoena me so I can give you some documents, and I'm working with the New York Times to do a big expose on it. And this, since this was right up the alley with what I was doing with the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, Psych Rights, whose mission is to mount a strategic litigation campaign against forced psychiatric drugging and electroshock, I agreed to do it. So I subpoenaed it and subpoenaed him, and he gave me the papers before Lilly objected, and we were off to the races. And these documents, you know, I was ultimately, Lilly came after me, and they got the court to prohibit me from, you know, possessing the documents or further disseminating them or distributing them. So I ended up not really being able to read them very much, but the New York Times had a series of front page stories about him, describing what I, you know, just said about the diabetes and other problems, and also that they were illegally marketing Zyprexa to the elderly, on whom it's particularly deadly, and also children, even little children, which was illegal.
Wow. I you know, as going through this, I've been doing all this on the radio for 12 years and have handled many cases. I'm not an attorney. I'm not a doctor. I'm not anything except an advocate. And when I read some of the things that go on in these so-called courtrooms, honest to God, it just makes you want to get up and slam your head in the wall. When I see what goes on at the FDA in protecting these companies and providing immunity, the idea that Lilly should have been able to withhold these documents, I think if you're going to market something to the public has every right to know everything about that product, and yet we are routinely prevented from knowing these adverse side effects. And what we have seen with people who have been put on Zyprexa is the onset of diabetes, this massive weight gain you talk about. It's almost like lithium that causes the, what they call moon face. It just, there's so many, you know, I have to jump to something here because it just keeps going through my mind. Towards the end of the book, you remark that they are trying to make it out that mental illness causes brain damage. And I was stunned when I read that because it doesn't cause brain damage. These medications do. But,
correct.
You know, they cause permanent damage to the frontal cortex of the brain. And they cause tardive dyskinesia. They cause so many lifelong things. And isn't it Haldol that can cause the onset of Parkinson's? I know Prozac
all,
will.
That's, all of these neuroleptics, which Haldol is one, Zyprexa, Risperdal, Thor is in,
yes,
you know, the first generation and second generation. I call them neuroleptics, which means,
yes,
seize the brain. And but they've been marketed as antipsychotics, but they don't have antipsychotic properties for many, if any. But yeah, they what they you know they block 70 to 90% of the dopamine in the frontal lobes, the basal ganglia, and the limbic system. And the basal ganglia, when you have 70 to 80% blockage of dopamine just naturally in the basal and the basal ganglia, that's when you get Parkinson's disease. And so this is a drug-induced Parkinson's. Parkinson's disease, basically, and dyskinesia is a, you know, is a terrible, irreversible brain damage. You know, where people have involuntary movements and things like that.
Yes, I knew one lady who actually suffered from that, and she shook constantly from one end to the other, and. And then another person that we came in contact with through the things that I do also had the dyskinesia, and her whole right side of her body tremored constantly, and she would chew constantly, and it was from the medication. You know, here, what was it, about 2 years ago, they came out trying to get the FDA to it, and I believe they did, and some states outlawed it, to approve electroshock therapy again, and they wanted to use it on children who were autistic and had, you know, acting out bouts and things, and put these jackets on them to shock them. And I thought, for God's sake, this is barbaric. You know, just absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so ahead. Electroshock has always, you know, ever since it was invented in, you know, I think the 1940s, it's always been going on, and the it was invented before the FDA was authorized to regulate medical devices, it was kind of grandfathered in, and then the FDA was supposed to take another look at it, and they convened an expert panel that basically said it shouldn't be approved for anything except catatonia. And that was a 7-6 vote or something like that. But then the FDA waited a couple of years and recently just basically approved it as such a low level harm that it's, you know, it's not any more dangerous than a cotton swab, for example. And so, so like you say, the FDA is not protecting us. Now there's also this jacket device that was shocking, you know, little kids. But they recently disapproved that, actually, I think, just within the last month or so.
Well, that was nice of them. You know, we face all kinds of challenges in our lives. And you go to your doctor and you think you're going to get help. And in this case, you go to a psychiatrist or a therapist who prescribes. And they have to go through a psychiatrist to do that here. I don't know how it is in other states. But how do you hand out medications that you know are actually not fixing the problem? When I researched several of these medications, several of them put out by Merck, who I think is second only to Monsanto in its threat to humanity, but they openly admitted they did not know what these drugs did when they hit the brain. They just thought it might help. That's not enough reason to give these to people. I mean, it's you're a guinea pig. They're waiting to see what happens.
So, I mean, there are a couple of thoughts I have. One is, you know, the question is, are the psychiatrists fooled, or are they complicit in, you know, in basically telling people that these drugs are safe and effective when they're neither? And I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. At this point, it seems very hard to believe that they don't know. But they just don't seem to. They don't even seem to look at what's happening to their patients. So it's very disturbing. I agree with you. People should be able to go to their doctor, their psychiatrist, and, you know, be able to rely on what they say. But it's just not the case. And it's a huge shame. I mean, that's the reason why we give doctors, you know, monopoly prescribing privileges, is because
right.
you're supposed to get expert advice. But it's just been so corrupted that the doctors have basically become, you know, part of the, you know, pharmaceutical industry's marketing.
Well,
process.
Yes. In my own experience here in the last 4 or 5 years, and I rarely ever go to the doctor. I'm in good health all the way around. But I'd had an issue and went to the doctor and was prescribed a medication that I was told was an antibiotic, turned out to be a chemotherapy drug, just relabeled.
Wow.
And, of course, there's lawsuits in district court all over up here, all over the country over this. When I complained to my doctor about, like, for instance, why my hair was falling, oh, you know, at your age, you know, as we get older,
right.
don't give me that crap. It doesn't happen overnight. I went home and started researching and got a ton of information about how these drugs were not to be given to people my age and with conjunction with corticosteroids or NSAIDs, most especially ibuprofen, it could become lethal. And I'm looking at it, I was just gobstopped. Went back to my doctor and said, why would you give me something that would threaten my life? Oh, we give it to a lot of people and nobody's ever complained. I said, there's a difference between nobody complained and you didn't report the adverse reaction. You didn't tell them it was a result of that drug. Oh,
well,
that's all conspiracy. Yeah. Well, her
yeah,
thing was it was all conspiracy
and they,
thing.
Yeah, and they just don't.
Yeah.
They don't connect it up with the drug. That's the problem. They just assume.
Yeah.
You know, assume it's not the drug. I mean. I'm here.
Okay. Yeah. No, what I ended up doing was I printed everything off from the FDA and the drug company and took it into her and said, how is it I can know more about this than you do? You're the doctor. I'm supposed to be able to trust you. And yeah. But I think many people, Mr. Gottstein, have come to this conclusion. Your doctor is the last place you want to go. Getting back to our subject at hand, What was it specifically they were trying to hide about these drugs? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, they were hiding that it caused this diabetes and other metabolic problems. And then doctors started seeing diabetes and these other metabolic problems. And they started, you know, downplaying it, and they instructed
uh-huh.
their sales reps to downplay it and divert attention and then say, you know, blame the patients, saying that they weren't exercising and eating too much. And people would gain weight and not be
yes.
eating very much. And then other people
yes.
would get diabetes even if they didn't gain weight.
Wow.
And, they manipulated the studies, although actually that was how Dr. Eagleman came to call me, was I had this Dr. Grace Jackson, this wonderful psychiatrist who had done for a case of mine, she had reviewed the clinical trials that were given to the FDA for approval. And she just went through and described, and she actually could see that it was causing diabetes just there. And so it wasn't really a surprise
yes.
to me. But anyway, so, she went into all these different manipulations that Eli Lilly did. For example, you're supposed to, in these randomized controlled studies, you're supposed to have a placebo arm and, the active arm. And it's supposed to be blinded, and the placebo arm is supposed to be, you know, just normal people that aren't being given anything. Well, for the placebo arm, they took people who'd been on Haldol for years and abruptly withdrew them. Okay, well, you know how I said that these drugs block 70 to 90% of the dopamine in the frontal lobe?
Yes.
Well, so what happens is that to compensate, the brain for the first few weeks tries to pump, you know, pumps out more dopamine to compensate for the blockage.
Okay.
And then it grows more. It actually grows more dopamine receptors. So whereas, you know, people diagnosed with schizophrenia don't have any, there's no discernible difference in their brains than people that don't haven't been diagnosed with schizophrenia before the drugs, after the drugs. That's there, you know, a number of brain changes, including brain shrinkage and all that. But one of them is this increase in dopamine receptors. So then when you withdraw people abruptly from the drug, then all of a sudden, you do have this excess dopamine, which there's no proof that people have that before, you know. And so
right.
a lot of people have withdrawal symptoms that are, you know, psychiatric symptoms. And
yes.
And so they're as so for the comparison group, they are using people that they've deliberately made their, you know, mental, you know, quote, mental illness, end quote, problems worse to compare that with how Zyprexa is. Okay, so that's one kind of fraudulent thing. Then what they did is, you know, a lot, you know, most people have these problems when they're abruptly withdrawn from Haldol, but some people actually do quite well, you know, when they're finally get off this drug. So they threw those people out of the study, skew the study. So that was one of the things that she found. And then another one was what they called last observation carried forward. So these studies were basically 12 weeks, you know, which is kind of ridiculous in the first place, because they, you know, put these people on these drugs for, you know, they say they should take them for the rest of their lives. But anyway,
yes.
the drugs make people feel so terrible, and with, you know, and basically a lot of people don't feel they help them, that, you know, basically up to 2/3 of the people just dropped out of the study. And so what they did is they say, okay, well, we're going to assume that they're going to be in the same condition at the end of 12 weeks that they were at the, you know, when they dropped out of the study, which might have been 2 weeks. Well, what's the point of doing a study if you're going to assume the results?
Yes.
So anyway, so Dr. Jackson, I had published, you know, I had posted that on the PsychRights website, psychrights.org, and actually the New York Times reporter found it and suggested that Dr. David Eagleman call me. And so then the papers that I got, you know, also showed that they were, you know, showed this diabetes. Are you still there?
Yes.
Okay.
Just listening.
So showed this diabetes, and that they were hiding it from doctors. And but this was then splashed all over the New York Times front page. And so whereas this report that Dr. Jackson did, you know, nobody really knew about it. Having it all over the front page of the New York Times was, you know, a really big deal and helped expose what, you know, the truth about Zyprexa.
Wow. And see, most of those drugs are exactly the same. I know people that have been put on, they had depression or something else, and instead of working their way through it, they were convinced if they took a medication, it would disappear. It does not. And they, one lady I knew, took something called Cymbalta. And once she took one pill and sat and stared at a wall, seriously, stared at a wall for about 6 hours, her eyes transfixed. I mean, just, it was absolutely terrifying that they do this to people, knowing that these drugs are detrimental, that they can be lethal, that they don't fix anything. You cannot take a drug to fix a psychiatric problem. If there is a mental illness, that has to be dealt with, but drugging somebody into oblivion is not the answer. One thing it does do is it shortens their lifespan. And most mentally ill people, and I think you mentioned this in your book, will live a normal life, which we're finding out they don't want to have happen. We have two states now that have made it official that you can starve those with mental illness, including dementia and Alzheimer's, to death rather than take care of them. Yeah, that's Wyoming and Connecticut. And they did pass those laws. And so, I mean, we've got, you know, we've got these things happen incrementally across the country. And it just, and that just happened this last year, by the way. And it's coming in on the heels of all these euthanasia laws. Hospice, of course, being the biggest beneficiary of that. But at some point, we've got to realize, and I believe this, we are being used as guinea pigs. They're experimenting, seeing what this does, seeing what that does. And if you succumb to it, well, too bad for you. We'll move on to the next one. The FDA, in my estimation, is absolutely the most worthless agency, right up probably next to the USDA. It absolutely provides no benefit to the public because you can buy them off if you got enough money. And we've seen that too many times. As you traveled through this and this came out, you came in contact with a man named Bill Bigley. You want to talk a little bit about him?
Well, one of the things is, as I write about in the book, I was really struck by "There but for the grace of God go I." So he was 2 years older than me, and he was hospitalized. Oh, no, 2 months older than me. And he was hospitalized 2 years before I was. I had, you know, a short hospitalization in 1982, and I was really lucky not to have been made permanently mentally ill by the system. And so from my perspective, what happened to Bill could have, you know, could have just as easily have happened to me if I wasn't so lucky. Part of it was that, you know, I came from a family with some resources and stature and stuff like that. And he was just a regular guy, but he was a regular guy. He had he was married and had two daughters and a good job as a heavy equipment operator. And then his wife divorced him and took his daughters and then he got saddled with alimony and child support that he couldn't handle. And so he had a nervous breakdown, which is what he ended up in the hospital. And that's what he told them. And so instead of helping with him with that, and interestingly, the psychiatrist that he had at the hospital was the same one that really saved my life a couple years later. But when he got discharged, the psychiatrist said his prognosis was guarded. And we don't know what's going to, you know, how it'll do.
Yeah.
Depending on how much help he gets with dealing with his divorce. And, he didn't get any help. And so this was in 1980. And he was cooperative the first time, you know, took the drugs. Left, and then, you know, but he decided they weren't helping him, and then he got hauled back again, and then they locked him up, which made him angry. I mean, that's kind of a natural response. And then he didn't want to take the drugs because they weren't helping him, which was Haldol. And they, back then, and this was another place I was lucky, is they decided when someone was given a therapeutic dose is when the drug started causing involuntary motor movements called extrapyramidal symptoms. Yeah. And so once they could see the brain damage being caused because people's, you know, movements became weird, then they, you know, that was when they decided, you know, that they were giving him a therapeutic dose. So they just slammed him with Haldol And that, that caused a lot of damage. So anyway, so then they start forcing him, and then things get increasingly worse, and he's, and I think 94 or something, I say that, they put him under a conservatorship, so they take, they take control of his money, and then I forget, maybe 2004 or something like that, they put him under a full guardianship where they take full control of their life. I mean, your listeners, I think, know about, guardianship.
Yes.
But it's like they put you in the legal status of a child. And, of course, that made him angry. And that ended up causing me a ton of trouble, because when I first met him in the hospital, I asked for him to be given a release of information so that they would give me his medical records. And they said, oh, only his guardian can do that. So they wouldn't even let him sign over his records to his lawyer. So it's just this, the amount of control that these, guardianships impose on people is really astounding.
It's tragic. And I have been dealing with this for many years, and these people are predators. That is the only way I can describe them. It's the only word I've ever found that describes them adequately. They are predators. And what we're seeing here, Mr. Godsine, is bills, because we fought the Minnesota legislature so hard over this. They're coming out with bills that look like they're going to help the person being targeted. But every paragraph in that bill that says you can't do this or that or you'll get in trouble, basically, is followed by unless otherwise ordered by a probate judge. Yeah.
Right.
And which, of course, neutralizes everything. One thing they have done in the bills, we found out and proved out legally, that calling someone, designating them a ward, causes them to suffer what's called a civil death. They don't exist in the law. And it's under this premise that they say you can't make any decisions, only the guardian has any say, because basically, as far as the law is concerned, you don't exist anymore. And when I spoke at the summit last year, I was approached afterwards and by a person who was also an attorney, and he said, I think you're misunderstanding something. And I said, well, then show me what I'm misunderstanding, I'll correct myself. And he just looked at me, and I said, what am I misunderstanding? Well, that isn't actually what ward means. I said, it most certainly is. And I said, check your lexicon. I said, check the U.S. Code and Title. I said, when you're declared a war, you suffered a civil death as if you've committed some severe criminal act. But there has been no damage to person or property here. And he just looked at me. So these new bills are coming out. They have stricken the word ward and put in the word person. And I was looking at that, and I thought it should have said the living man or woman. And everything is done to dance around doing that. And so I looked up the definition of person in the Minnesota statute, and it's a corporation or other business entity. And I thought, now, wait a minute.
Well, it can include that. I don't know that it's restricted to that.
Well, it doesn't say anything else. It just says it's a corporation or business, other business entity. And but see, this parsing of words, and you think a word means one thing, but according to the court, it means something else. And I think this causes a lot of unnecessary complication, but of course it's always beneficial to the predators in the system, it seems to me. When this guardianship was implemented, for what reason? What reason did they have for doing this?
Well, they basically said, that he was incapable of managing his life. He'd been out of control of his money for a long time, but, so they, just basically, It was, but that's what they said.
Yeah.
But what it was really about was trying to control them and keep them from, you know, bothering people so much.
Yeah. Yeah. And instead of trying to help him, yeah, it's just easier to target him. This stuff, to me, just even all these years later, it upsets me so bad. And
so,
that this can be done to people. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it was interesting. I mean, I write about this in the book. I got to know him pretty well. And he was angry, and I think legitimately so. And he would yell at people. That was, you know, what got people upset. But he was never violent, as far, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as I know, and I think I would have known if he'd ever been violent.
Yeah.
Even though he was provoked. I got to know him pretty well. And I said, look, and he was, by this time, he'd been in the hospital 75 times, you know. And
oh, wow.
At that time, you know, it cost them about $1,000 a day to keep him in the hospital. And he wasn't staying out very long. And so I put together this, you know, proposal for how to help him when he was out of the hospital, which was, you know, basically, you know, some people do, you know, kind of manage if they don't have housing, if they're homeless. Bill was not one of them. And even for anybody, being homeless is, you know, a terrible thing and
yes.
really hard to deal. It's hard to deal with. But so, you know, I said, okay, you need to give him housing. And you need to have someone available to be with him, you know, when there get to be those interactions with people that, you know, can escalate and create problems, just to kind of de-escalate things. And then there were some other things, but that was the basic thing. And the hospital, you know, and the state fought tooth and nail against, you know, having to provide that.
Right.
And the judges just go along with whatever the, you know, the hospital says.
Yes.
And the state says, almost always. First, Psych Rights had a small amount of money that it could put towards providing that for a while, and it worked quite well. But couldn't do that indefinitely, and so he got into trouble again, and the hospital wouldn't agree to it. But then after, you know, they got the judge to say, no, I'm not going to require that, then they, you know, they actually provided pretty similarly, and he did quite well for months. So I think that's the main point. You just need to, you know, find ways to help people. And it's like you say, it's not the drugs. The drugs are a trap.
Yes.
They might knock down symptoms for a short period of time, but only that. And then, you know, they're hell to come off of. And if you even can, and they cause lots of problems, including causing psychiatric symptoms.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And in the case of this gentleman you're speaking about, at $1,000 a day in-house, they would have spent far less helping him on the outside than what it was costing, because on top of that, of course, is the cost of these medications and whatever else they can throw on there. So, this is where things disconnect really bad for me. They'll put people in these institutions, drug them to half to death, into oblivion, and then at some point say, well, there's nothing else we can do for you, and put them out the door. What is it they think's going to happen? They know exactly what's going to happen. They're going to come back in a very short period of time. We'll start the process all over again. But there's no follow-up. There's no aftercare. There's nothing, and you cannot take somebody who's already compromised out of that situation, which basically is secure in the fact that they're locked in, and they don't have to worry about keeping a roof or something to eat most times. and then throw them out and say, well, you're all better, as good as we can get you. See ya.
There's
something wrong in that.
Yeah. In Alaska, unlike in a lot of places, I mean, there's a lot of similarities all around the country. But one of the things about Alaska is they tend not to keep very many people for a long time. I mean, in some places they'll keep people for years and decades. But in Alaska, what they do is they bring people in, they drug them up, and these drugs basically make people so lethargic. That,
yes.
You know, you talked about your friend who stares at the, you know, the wall, and, you know, I mean, basically,
yep.
So they just can't do anything, and that's what they consider the therapeutic effect. You know, that's what they say, and they say, oh, they're doing so much better, and then what they try and do is they hook them up with social services, and then try and put them in a group home or what they call them assisted living facilities, and. In Alaska, you know, and require that they take the drugs to keep them in that state. And so everybody is basically making money
yes.
on this person to provide these services to basically keep them sick. You know, and like Bill, he was given, you know, he had, you know, disability payments, you know, by that time and stuff. And, you know, and they basically took all of it. For housing and
yes.
stuff, and he would get $10 a day, I think.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing too. They do this, and you, what you mentioned is that everybody's making money. You take one person in a community that's on, let's say, Social Security, and you suck them into this system one way or another, and whoever that guardian is makes themselves the assigned payee on that check. And then they house them somewhere that's paid by the state or federal funding. And then Medicare kicks in and takes care of their medical bills, and all those people are making money. And, you know, I keep reminding people there isn't a Medicare patient out there that has the right to bill or collect fees from Medicare. It's the medical industry. And this includes psychiatry. And so everybody is getting a piece of this person who is targeted. And if their life gets destroyed and they physically are destroyed in the process, again, too bad for you. And this could be handled so much more efficiently and to the betterment of these people if it was just done a better way. But this is all about the money. I concluded that long ago. None of this is to benefit anybody they have targeted. It's how much money can we make off of them? You know,
I try not to ascribe bad motives to everybody. I mean, certain people for sure, but, you know, so I think, you know, a lot of these people have kind of drunk the Kool-Aid and just, you know, just think, oh, these, you know, this person has this defective brain and, you know, the best we can hope for
yeah.
is to keep them in
yeah.
this, you know, bare, you know, survival
yeah.
mode, and, you know, and we're just trying to help them. But so I don't know, but the result is certainly, you know, the same, which is the people basically live, you know, very low quality lives, as you can hardly call it
yes.
living. And then everybody is making very, you know, very good living,
yes.
You know, billing the government to provide so-called services
yes.
to this person.
Yes, exactly. What stunned me through all of this is the callousness of these people who do this, the total disregard, lack of regard for the fact that that's a fellow human being. It's how much money can we make? How much is this going to make for us? We've actually got court papers where we've gotten email strings back and forth between attorneys talking about how much money they anticipate making off of a case. And if we do this or that or something else and stall this out for a while, we can make another 10 grand. Stop. Please stop. You know, this, like I say, this is a human being you're dealing with. It's not. And we also have many documents showing that these people are referred to as units or merchandise, not even as human beings. Units, merchandise, product, a commodity. Let's sell it. And I have a real issue with all of that. This is allowed to go on. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the really insidious things about the system is that, you know, a diagnosis of a serious mental illness basically kind of makes the person a non-person, which is kind of a different way
right.
of describing what you're saying. And so, it's like, you know, I hate to say it, but like people think of them as, you know, not even really human, which is what you're saying. And it really derives from this idea of diagnosis of especially serious mental illness, which, and this idea that it's a brain defect, which has never been proven. I mean, the psychiatrist has been looking for some kind of, you know, brain defect or gene or something, and for 100 years, over 100 years, and they haven't found it. They keep saying, "Oh, we're sure we're going to find it," whereas the people who, you know, have gone through it and have, you know, come out the other side, like I have, and I write about a number of such people in my book, and that's the reason, because I want to kind of show people that, you know, it's not really true that, you know, it's a lifelong disease. It's almost always, if it's truly something that gets diagnosed, you know, with, you know, as a mental illness, it's almost always, you know, something or a series of things that have happened to people that, you know, have created, you know, this way of thinking. And you just need to find a way to, you know, help people deal with things. So, for example, there's this Hearing Voices Network. Do you know about the Hearing Voices Network?
No, I didn't.
It came out of actually the Netherlands, but it was really strong in the United Kingdom and now is making inroads here, where it's, you know, people who hear voices and what they don't, and it's kind of, you know, peer support groups, basically, is the idea. And they don't ask what's wrong with you. Their question is, what happened to you? And it turns out that a pretty large percentage, around 10% of the population, hear voices. But it's only about 1% that get diagnosed with schizophrenia because the voices are causing them to behave in ways that cause problems for the person. And so what the Hearing Voices Network does is, you know, say, okay, the thing is to be able to, you know, deal with, you know, the voices, and, you know, so that it's not causing you so many problems. And some people, as a result of that, the voices go away. And some people, the voices don't really go away, but people learn to, you know, adapt to it. Like some people might even go, okay, well, I'm going to make an appointment with you to talk to you later. I'm not going to talk to you now.
Yeah.
You know, and things like that. And some people find voices really helpful, you know, but they don't get diagnosed with schizophrenia. So it's just things that, you know, basically things that have happened to people. And I think, you know, that used to be the common understanding of, what gets called mental illness, that, you know, does, you know, that drove the person crazy, right? I mean, that's kind of what people thought.
Right.
And this idea that it's some kind of brain defect really benefits the psychiatric profession because they kind of then get to be the sole purveyors of, you know, the so-called treatments to it because you know, there are a lot of different groups that people that provide psychotherapy, but only the psychiatrists or MDs get to prescribe the drug. So by converting it into a medical problem, it really solidified the psychiatry's, you know, role in this, you know, financial interest.
Well, I think they shot themselves in the foot with the DSM-5. And it's, I can't remember, I think it's something like 322 invented mental disorders. And and then it'll say, for instance, grieving over the loss of someone who died close to you, and you have this disorder, because that's not a disorder, that's a natural human process. But it'll say non-specified. What does that mean? And
right.
But they come up and,
so, yeah,
they
you,
come
you
to
get
all these
2 weeks if you grieve for more than two. It used to be 2 months, but I think now it's 2 weeks. If if you grieve for more than 2 weeks, then now all of a sudden you have a mental illness.
Yeah. Yeah. They've come up, and all of it is, if every bit of it is not objective, it's subjective. They invent the disorder. They all vote on it. And usually these disorders are invented to, facilitate the bringing out of another drug. They have a drug specifically for this that will help with this specific thing. Darn it, it was just a coincidence. And then you find out that the same psychiatrists sitting on this committee that vote and argue about all this stuff have direct ties to the pharmaceutical companies. And they speak for them. They do, speaking engagements for them. They promote them. They do all kinds of things. So you have a conflict of interest. But when that came out, I'm telling you, everybody was just about on the floor until it dawned on them they were going to use this stuff against them. You look at these mental tests like the MPI 1 and 2 developed at the University of Minnesota. They have three stages. They call them axles in it. And it 500 questions to each section. And you go through there and you're repeatedly asked the same question over and over and over, but phrased a different way. If they don't catch you in the first section, they'll catch you in the second or the third. And usually by that time, you're suffering from severe fatigue, as I understand it. But the thing is, they are scored answers. So there is no way you can take this test, no conceivable way, that you cannot come away with it with at least three mental disorders. And nobody can. They're geared that way. The PF-16, the same thing. These tests are skewed so that you can't win. There is no right answer. But it's all scored, and it's a numerical number that determines what you have. That score is applied to various supposed mental ailments. And they just have to look up under that number, like, say, for instance, the number 10. And you go to the number 10, it'll show you all the disorders that could be applied. And it's really quite a scheme. But here again, this was funded by the pharmaceutical industry to promote these drugs. And like I say, they come up with these supposed disorders that they just conveniently happen to have a drug that will treat. Ed, I don't think that makes a person – oh, go ahead.
Yeah, well, one of the worst things, I don't know, but one of the really bad things that, happened is they have, these, quote, screening tests, for children and adolescents,
Yes.
It was called Teen Screen at one point, although it got so discredited, they kind of went underground. But it was like an 80% false positive. And that just, drives people into, they'll go see a psychiatrist and getting these drugs. And when you talk about a group of vulnerable people, it's foster children.
Yes.
They all get pretty much screened for, quote, mental illness, and they pretty much all get put on the drugs. And if you think about a foster child, the way, a child or adolescent gets into foster care is they've been found to have been the subject of abuse or neglect. Okay, uh-huh. So that may or may not be true.
Mm-hmm.
But even let's say that it is true. Okay, well, if you've been a child or adolescent, you've been subject to, abuse or neglect, that's, pretty likely to cause you to act out, right? It's a natural thing that kids do. Okay, so then you yank them out of their house because of that. Well, some, children, youth are glad to be taken out of those kind of situations. But for a lot of children, no matter how bad it is at home, being yanked out of their house is also traumatic, and that will cause them to
act out,
right? Okay, then they're put in these foster homes, and quite a few of them are really pretty terrible. And the children are treated, second class citizens, and blah, 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 blah. And that can cause them to act out. And so then they give them these, screenings, and and send them to psychiatrists, and they're virtually, almost all of them have been given psychiatric drugs at some time, and a big chunk of them given these neuroleptics.
Yes.
And so, and then they're told that they have this, brain defect that they have no control over. And they're, forget about having any kind of, satisfactory life, and you're going to have to be drugged for the rest of your life. Well, these are just the worst messages to give children and youth. What we should be doing first is helping the parents be better parents. Okay.
Yes.
I think, there's some parents that, that treat their children bad and kind of, do it deliberately and stuff. But most parents try and do the best they can for their parents, for their children.
Right.
And we should help them with that. And then the next thing that we should be doing is helping the children become successful.
Yes.
Not say there's something wrong with them. If you say that there's, that there's a defective brain and there's nothing they can do about it, well, that takes responsibility away from them. And what we need to be teaching children is how, is to take responsibility, to be responsible, to be able to, control their reactions to their emotions so that they, behave in a way that is socially acceptable, and then be successful in school and stuff like that. But instead, we say there's nothing you can do about it, and that's just the absolute worst message to send.
Well, it was here, about 5 or 6 years ago, the state of Florida got nailed. 80% of all their foster children were on massive numbers of drugs, and they were using them for vaccine testing. They were being leased out, literally leased out as chattel property to the pharmaceutical companies for testing. Some of these kids were on as many as 6 of these psychotropic medications a day. What brought attention to it was 3 children under the age of 5 died from these drugs. And that brought it all to a head. And when this was revealed, a couple of psychiatrists went to prison. They brought a bill out in Florida and that making it illegal to drug foster children. The FDA ran in there with bags of money and stopped that. They said the state second to Florida in the abuse of foster children was Alaska, and they were doing the same thing. The only state I know of that has given foster children any rights is New Mexico, and here 3 years ago, they passed a bill about even children had the right to refuse drugging and vaccines, and they said, and they made a special statement saying even foster children, as if these kids were less, even these kids have a right to say no. And the battle in New Mexico was fierce by the senators and representatives who were being backed by pharmaceuticals against passing this bill, but it did pass. And it's the only state I've known of where foster children do have rights. The right to refuse medication and vaccines, and which I think is quite necessary. But what we're doing to kids is just absolutely, it's uncalled for. It's unnecessary. I agree with you. Instead of jerking these kids out of their homes and traumatizing them, try to help the family. It'd save a lot of money, save a lot of anxiety and stress. And it might save those children. But,
right.
And so much has come out, Mr. Gottstein, about how CPS in just the last year took over 700,000 children away from their families with absolutely no evidence of wrongdoing. And they're just now getting called on the carpet about this. And but that is because it's cash incentivized through the federal government. And those people are after those dollars. They have to fill a quota, and they'll do it one way or another to keep their job. But there's so much going on. We've got just a couple minutes left here. I want to remind everybody, Mr. Gottstein's book is available on Amazon. You can direct link it right off the PPJ. It's there in the promo. Or you can just type Amazon into your browser and Zyprexa Papers. It'll pull it right up. It's less than $20. It's a good book. I suggest everybody read it. It is a very readable book, and I think it's important in what it reveals about what's going on with these medications. Mr. Gottstein, I want to thank you for coming on this evening, and we might want to talk with you again if you're willing.
You bet. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. And everybody, thank you for tuning in, and we will be back tomorrow night with the show on hospice, and then Thursday night with another whistleblower show. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate your taking time to be with us, and we'll talk to you then. Good night, everyone.